of what the characteristics of American Jewry are. For anyone who's been following the Jewish press since 12:01 a.m. on October 1, when the study was released, you see all sorts of different opinions basically reflecting the positions that I think people started with at the beginning. To get this conversation going, what I'd like to do is to summarize the results. I'll try to do it as straight as I can without spinning the data, I hope that will produce a useful conversation. So, the first thing about the study is how many Jews did they actually find in the United States? And the finding is that there are 4.2 million adults who say that their religion is Judaism. Now, they didn't actually talk to 4.2 million adults. They actually talked to only about 4,000 people. And they estimate this number based on the number of people whom they sampled. They found that in addition to the 4.2 million, there were 1.1 million, again, it's an estimate, individuals who say that they are Jewish, that they consider themselves Jewish, but their religion is not Judaism. And then they said that, and I put it in quotes, that there were 1.3 million children being raised as Jews. Note that definition, being raised as Jews. And it turns out there are another half a million Jewish children, or children who live in households with Jewish parents, who weren't counted as part of the population, and they said that the total population was 6.7 million. Now, interestingly, and it's not been widely discussed, there's another group that they identified, and these are, first, the non-Jews of Jewish background who are adults. So these are people who have Jewish parents, who in most cases were raised as Jews, but according to Pew, which is and the research group that did this studies religion, these people should not and were not counted as Jews because they had another religion. And there were 1.1 million children who are part of the families of these 2.4, so about 3.5 additional million people. Now, what's really curious about this, and I'll show you some of the information in a moment, is that 70% of this group, even though they supposedly have another religion, consider themselves to be Jews. And if we were market researchers, we might say, well, no, the population is not just the 7 million, but we have a potential other 3 million or so people who could be part of our community. Why isn't this working right? Oops. Well, this is supposed to show, I don't know why my slide isn't working on this machine. I don't know if, give me a hand here. What I wanted to show you, because this has been so much a focus of the discussion, is that the estimate of 6.7 million, on the one hand, is a much larger estimate of the Jewish population than anyone had. I have animation in that, and should work. That the 6.7 million is higher. Does anybody remember what NJPS 2000-2001 found? 5.2 million. And that was a decrease of 300,000 from 1990, when the population was supposedly 5.5 million. And on that basis, people were predicting a decline in the Jewish population. So this is a substantial increase. What I was trying to show you here is that the 6.7 million, one of the ways that we know, or one of the reasons that we believe that it's an accurate number and it's not a made-up number, is that it is very close to the number, this will be a little bit perhaps self-aggrandizing, the number that my own group has published even before this study came out. And our number is based on compiling hundreds and hundreds of surveys that ask questions about people's religion and their ethnic identity. So basically, the good news, Shira said there is good news in this study, is that the Jewish population is much greater than people thought and is actually increasing, perhaps not as fast as the American population in general, but is increasing nevertheless. You missed some beautiful pictures here. The second is that in terms of who American Jews are, the largest denominational affiliation is the Reform Movement. It's now about 35% of the total population. That includes both people who are Jews by religion as well as Jews not by religion. What's the growingest, what's the fastest growing denomination label way of identifying?
No.
It's actually this thing called just Jewish, or they label it here, no denomination. So what's happened, and it's particular with young people, is that folks are refusing to be classified or associated with a denomination, even people who daven in a particular denomination-affiliated synagogue. The change, by the way, is that there's been a reduction in the number of people who identify as conservative, and there has been a slight increase in the number, or the proportion, I should be very careful here, in the proportion who identify as Orthodox, from about 8% to just over 10%. Now, one of the things that I think people have had the most difficulty understanding and appreciating about the Pew study is what Jews really think they are when they say that they are Jewish. Now, Pew, because they come from a religion-based approach, and their big prior sets of research on other religious groups had to do with the people that they called the nuns, not the N-U-N-S's, but the N-O-N-E-S's, people who had no religion, even though they were brought up in a particular faith. In the case of Judaism, and this slide doesn't appear particularly clearly here, but what it shows is that when people were asked the question, what is being Jewish mainly about? Only a small percentage said that it was mainly about religion. The dominant answer was ancestry and heritage. And interestingly, that answer was given not only by the people who are Jews of no religion, but also by the people who are Jews of religion. The majority said ancestry and culture. One of the other things that came out of the study, and it's unequivocally good news, is that people who say that they are Jewish, again, whether it's by religion or by or not by religion, by some other criteria, are proud to be Jewish. Virtually everybody says that being Jewish is a great thing, that they're proud of it. What it also says is that people feel that they have a connection to this thing, we call it Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. And that being Jewish is somewhat or very important in their lives. Almost everybody says that. There are a whole set of other questions, and some of these actually have been misinterpreted, so and you may have heard different interpretations of these. They asked, what does being Jewish mean to you? What's essential, what's important, and what's not important? Now, for those who know a little bit of social science, that's not a really good scale, because essential and important are both positive, and not important is negative. But if you look here, what is unequivocal is that the ethical dimensions of Judaism, and it's not just confined to a particular branch denomination of the Jewish community, that the ethical dimensions of being Jewish, leading an ethical moral life, working for justice and equality, these are universally seen as the essential and important components of what it is to be Jewish. Caring about Israel is seen as essential by almost half, and the other half see it as important. Also on the list is having a good sense of humor. I wish I could tell a good joke about that.
You just did.
Okay. One of the interesting things, and I'm going to, as like parry against the question that's going to come from somebody here. I know at least several dozen of you are thinking this. Is it the fact that the Pew study found almost 7 million Jews, many more than other people thought, simply because they had a looser definition of who is a Jew? Well, it turns out their definition is actually more conservative, more stringent, if you will, than the definition of NJPS 2000. If you were to compare NJPS 2000 using the same definitional criteria to Pew, probably you would say that the population grew by 2 million, from something like 4.7 million to 6.7 million. Probably a methodological error. We didn't really grow that much in the last 13 years. But what's interesting here is that in this Jewish background group, you've got about 70%, I'm including them alongside the two Jewish categories, you have about 70% whose current religion, supposedly, is Protestantism or Catholicism. Yet, 25% of them consider Judaism very important. A number of them, almost a third of them, fasted on Yom Kippur. Many of them went to Seder and so on. The negative news in this set of questions is that synagogue attendance is not, I use the social science term for it, it's not a normative behavior on a regular basis. Is that a nice way of putting it, Rabbi?
Well done.
It's one of the questions that I think every community has to grapple with. And particularly to the extent that here in the diaspora in America, the synagogue is the center of our, not only our religious life, but also in some respect, in many respects, our cultural life. Okay. This is just quickly attitudes towards Israel. The interesting thing here is that despite the discussion of detachment, distancing from Israel, there is absolutely no evidence that that is the case. In other words, the attitudes, the strong support for Israel, is the attachment to Israel is exactly where it was from data that we've collected over the last 25 years. I put in the last column about 18 to 29 year olds because the biggest change is that young people who were never highly attached to Israel. Attachment to Israel was something that grew with age and also the opportunity to visit Israel, to actually go to Israel. We now have a situation where young people look in many ways like their grandparents and their parents. And of course, the underlying reason is
Birthright
Israel. I believe Birthright Israel, which is now sent from North America. Close to 250,000 young people. And in this 18 to 29 year old group, you've got 15 to 20%, maybe a little bit above that, who've gone, amongst the 18 to 29 year olds, about half of them have been, half the ones who've gone to Israel have been on Birthright Israel. and it is slowly penetrating that entire cohort. City Guide membership, just wanted to, which is distinct from synagogue attendance. That wasn't a joke. And here what you see is what's the respondent and somebody else in their household or know, that only about a third of American Jews are members of a synagogue. And as I showed you earlier, that group doesn't attend synagogue very often. This, again, is one of the issues that needs to be discussed, and I hope we'll discuss it later on. These are probably impossible to read, but I just wanted to identify Jewish education and basically the lack of Jewish education as one of the issues that the survey uncovers. Relatively low levels of participation in day school and even in supplemental school. I don't think this will be visible to most of you. This should be a little bit easier to read, and in some ways tells an even more distressing story. What it says is that of American Jews, only about half of them can distinguish Aleph from Beth, and only a little over 10% can have a conversation, the Hebrew and in Hebrew. And one of the questions is whether Hebrew is either a barrier to participation, or if Hebrew education is the key to increasing participation. And this is just a slide with involvement with Jewish organizations. I wanted to end, glad to answer questions later on, but I wanted to end by going back to 1964. I've actually been thinking a lot, and I suppose many of you have been thinking a lot in the wake of the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination and what happened in November of 1963, and that started me thinking about that whole year from where I was on that Friday afternoon to what happened over the next several months. Well, several months later, in May of 1964, Look magazine had a feature article called it's at the top, The Vanishing American Jew. And actually, if you read it, if you go back and read it, it's easy to find on Google, you could think you're reading the Pew survey of 2013. It's really scary. Study reveals loss of Jewish identity, soaring rates of intermarriage, Judaism may be losing 70% of its children born to mixed couples. Because of low birth rate, Jews are scarcely reproducing themselves. Well, what do you know? Look magazine vanished 2 years later. And look at all the people here tonight.
Next up, we have LeBron Schrag. And Barry was one of the first voices out there finding so many of the positive aspects in the Pew report.
Just for the record, I'd much rather think of myself as the Tom Brady. Because the Jewish people in Boston could be down by 14 points with a minute and a half left, and don't ever give up faith. Just trust in Brady and Belichick and Robert Kraft, and you'll be pretty good. Okay. Do you hear that, Robert? Good. Thank you very much. I want to start by quoting my favorite Jewish prophet, who once said, in response to people prophesizing, see, he's got the report down pat, that's right. What he's got there is right. It's all the interpretation that you've heard. that is just wrong. So I'll quote one of my favorite rabbis about this, who said, "Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will later be win, for the times they are a-changing." How many of you are old enough to know? There you go. Bobby Zimmerman, that's right. So I want to make just a couple of points about this in terms of what we think this thing means. And, you know, and Lynn alluded to this. So my feeling is it doesn't exactly matter what we are. It sort of matters what we want to be. That's really a far more important question. So for example, if we want 80% of our people in 70 years or 100 years to say, "I am proud to be a Jew," one quarter Jewish, one half Cherokee, one quarter African-American, and I'm proud of all of those things. Now that's one kind of future. It's not, for me, a promising future. It's not what I would call a future that's filled with Jewish Renaissance and Jewish meaning. Now, there's nothing wrong with people wanting to be exactly what they want to be. This is America. But you want something more. This is a 3,500-year-old spiritual tradition. It teaches social justice. It contains all the secrets of community. It helps you to figure out what your life means, where you come from, where your roots are. And you may have heard me say this before, you know, we give our kids everything. America's great. You can earn a living. You can live in freedom. You can live free of anti-Semitism. But a life without meaning and purpose and community, what have we robbed them of? Some of you have taken Maya. The best outcome I can think about Maya is when a person walks out and says, "My parents cheated me. That I never knew. I never knew that this tradition has meaning and importance. I thought it was nonsense, but it turns out it's life-changing." So for all of those reasons, we need to think about what we want to be far more than what it is that we are. What do we want our children to learn? As Len said, Jewish education is crucial, but it's only crucial if you have a dream for your children. You know, the idea that this is something, that there's something shocking in this, it's shocking to think that there's something shocking in this. I mean, we have been living through 100 years of pedal to the metal assimilation. This is the most assimilatory culture since Hellenism changed the entire face of the world. This is an entirely powerful, to think that you're going to get through this, you know, with no Jewish learning on your part, and with your kids in Hebrew school one day a week, and that this is going to turn the tide in some other direction. Again, you have to think about what you want. That's what we ask people to do. Think about what you want. Think about a next generation or a generation after that will forget why we believe in social justice. A generation that may never have heard at the Passover table, "Remember that you were strangers in the land of Egypt," because they never will have heard it before. What is it that we want for our children? What kind of lives do we actually want? And how do we begin to create exactly that kind of community? So there's huge pessimism about this. You know, failing institutions. Synagogues are failing. Federations are failing. Next generation refuses to get involved. Gosh, I don't know. Why are you guys building an enormous addition to the building? Why are you doing that? I mean, I understand that this synagogue is bursting at the seams. Or you could walk down the road to Beth Elohim or go to Temple Emmanuel or go to a dozen other synagogues and find out they're actually doing great. Why are they doing great? Because they aspire to be great. Because they believe that their central role is not to get kids to somehow walk into a Hebrew school that doesn't mean anything, but to create Hebrew schools that are truly meaningful. That's why CJP is in partnership with this synagogue and with Temple Emmanuel and with Beth Elohim to create synagogues that can actually transmit beauty and meaning to their children on every level. That's what we need to do. So guess what? This synagogue is bursting at the seams. It's not failing. And guess what? Most federations actually have boards with an average age of 75 to deceased. And no offense to any of the deceased who are over here. But CJP's average, the average age of our board is 50, with many people under 40. We're bringing in hundreds and hundreds and thousands of young adults into all kinds of programs, in all kinds of institutions and agencies. One of the big debates about this survey is going to be, how do we go forward? In other words, one theory is, lock the door on interfaith families and tell them that they're just not wanted, therefore other people may not intermarry, and they believe that intermarriage itself is the enemy. This would be a tragic mistake, Because, and I'll just give you one example. So one of the results of the Pew survey is that 22% of interfaith families are raising their kids as Jews. That's one of the numbers. And 22% are members of synagogues or send their kids to Jewish school, 22%. In Boston, we think that's something closer to 50%. So how will the future change? What about all the pessimism? If instead of 22%, we can make it 50%, because if we act and do something and welcome people, as the reform movement has been doing, as this synagogue has been doing, as interfaithfamily.com has been doing, you know, we can create our own future. So, I love Rabbi Soloveitchik. Some of you may remember him, who were raised in this community. He was one of the premier, along with Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the premier philosophers of Jewish life in the 20th century. And he said that we are not a people of fate, we are a people of destiny. In other words, our future does not belong to the past. We are drawn to some kind of different future. We are drawn to a great future, a future that's filled with learning and justice and meaning and purpose. And if the past says to us, you are locked into doom and destruction and deterioration, your institutions, we say, no, we control our future. The Pew study doesn't control our future. We control our future. We can be what we want to be, but we have to know what we're doing. I had a wonderful friend, the late Michael Hammer, wrote all kinds of books about business and wrote Reengineering the Corporation. And he used to quote from Alice in Wonderland, which said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. For the most part, for many institutions in the American Jewish community, and unfortunately for the vast majority of federations, that's exactly the situation. You know, they have no dream that they follow, no goal that they're looking forward to, other than raising more money than last year. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But if that's why you're in business, you will not change the Jewish future and you will not raise more money. Your goal has to be bigger than that. And that's why our partnerships with synagogues really focus, you know what, should we go low or should we go high? What's our goals for the future of the Jewish people and the Jewish community? So some people say, there are so many interfaith families in our synagogues and Jewish life, let's go for the lowest common denominator kind of teaching we can do. And I say, no, the non-Jewish spouses are, in many cases, much more interested in serious Jewish life than their husbands are or their wives are. You know, you can't go low here. We have a highly educated, brilliant next generation, and we need to feed them something substantive. This is a big question here. Should we abandon seriousness? I'm in debates with everybody, including some rabbis in the community, about this question. And I would say, you know what? If it's not serious, then it's nothing. And in fact, there's a new, wonderful new report on Pew by a guy named Don Seaman, a university professor. And what he says that actually is that it's not that Jews of no religion are secular. That means, you know, what they study, Achad Ha'am, and they've studied every kind of Jewish literature. And no, when people say they're Jews of no religion, it basically means, according to him, I think the statistics, in many cases, they're Jews that don't care about either social justice in a Jewish sense, or about Jewish literature, or about Jewish culture. They're merely saying that they're on their way out. They're checking out. You know, I saw a great debate in Israel between Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. You should all read every single one of his books. And Fania Oz Sulzberger, Amos Oz's daughter. And so she is the ultimate secular Jew, right? And he's the ultimate modern Orthodox religious Jew. And you know what? They didn't disagree about anything. It was all about the intensity and the beauty of Jewish literature and culture. It was a love fest. Because what's the difference between a serious religious Jew and a serious secular Jew? Is it that one believes in God and one doesn't believe in God? What's the difference? I once had a great discussion with the ultimate guy. This guy would definitely be listed as Jew of no religion. According to Pew, a no good Jew, right? According to many of the interpretations. This guy is Alan Dershowitz, right? So Alan says, in fact, the book that he wrote was called The Vanishing American Jew. And he believes that Jewish learning for adults is extremely important, central, but only secular. So I went to him one day, I said, Alan, you're secular. He goes, strictly secular. I go, why are you strictly secular, Alan? I ran into your rabbi yesterday. She says you're in shul every week. He goes, it's purely social. It has nothing to do with it. I go, oh, I get it. And you teach Talmud to your law students 3 times a week? The Talmud is the culture of the Jewish people. It has nothing to do with religion. I'm not religious. I'm a completely secular Jew. I go, you send your kids to the Rashi school. He goes, it's a wonderful school. I said, I love the Rashi school. I know it's a wonderful school, but, you know, what is it? And I go, so I guess you have no ritual, right? Because you're secular, right? He goes, no. He goes, I have kids. Of course I light Shabbos candles, and I say Kiddush. And I go, what makes you a secular Jew? He says, I'm not sure I believe in God. I said, half the members of my Orthodox synagogue aren't exactly sure that they believe in God or what kind of God exactly. Our God thing is very strange, you know? So, and most Jews are neither secular nor religious. They're actually someplace in between, which is half the problem with the Pew study and this Jews of no religion thing. What does any of this mean? So I'll just go back to the key question, which is, why not, you know, educate yourselves? It's beautiful. Why not give a decent Jewish education to your kids? I don't exactly know whether it'll prevent them from intermarrying or not, or what it'll say about their future, but in and of itself, it's gorgeous. Jewish learning is gorgeous. Shabbat I can't say to you that it's commanded, but for me as an Orthodox Jew, Friday afternoon, like everybody else here, I'm working 20 hours a day. By the time Friday afternoon comes, every part of my body is closing down because it's a beautiful thing. So I'm saying there are parts of Judaism that are simply beautiful. You don't have to feel commanded to know that there are things that you can give your kids that would make them better people, better human beings. Not that people who aren't Jewish aren't better human beings, but this is our special thing, our special role to play in the dialogue among civilizations, which is what Jonathan Sacks would say. So I'll leave you with one thought. So Moses is at the bush, and it's burning, and God says to him, I've got a little job for you. You're going to go to the most powerful king in the world. You're going to tell him he's no good. You can tell him he's not really a god. You're going to tell him to let your people go, and everything will be okay. And Moses goes, everything will be okay. He goes, everything will be okay. Moses says, at least tell me your name. And God says, Ehyesh Ehyeh, which is mistranslated as I am what I am. But the true translation, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks would say, is I will be what I will be. And then Jonathan Sacks says, what's the meaning of this for Moses? God is saying, I will be what I will be, but you will determine the outcome. So I would say, Pew will be what Pew will be. But all of you and your rabbi and our community, we will determine the outcome.
If Barry is Tom Brady, can I be Dustin Pedroia? So I wish to begin tonight by also thanking Barry and Len for coming to share their wisdom and their insight, and very special thank you to CJP for helping us to coordinate such a rich and wonderful evening. Each year during our High Holy Days, we pause in our life journey in order to reflect upon the very nature of our own life journeys. Who are we? And who are we becoming, we ask ourselves. In what ways do we need to change in order to grow into the kind of people that we aspire to be? The recent Pew survey, in many respects, is a kind of cheshbon nefesh, an accounting of the collective soul of our American Jewish community. It presents not only important data to be analyzed and reanalyzed, but also an opportunity for us to consider who we are in relationship to who we aspire to be. Jewish life represents both a vision and a path. More than simply being a religion or a culture or a people which shares a common ancestry, Judaism uniquely combines all of these into something much bigger and much more grand. In the Genesis narrative, Abraham and Sarah accept the covenantal call to create a people of sacred meaning, a family called upon to help all of us see in each other the image of God, a people committed to creating a society grounded in justice and compassion and care, and not just for ourselves. Ours is a community whose light is to make a positive difference individually and collectively by bringing goodness, by inspiring strength, and by sharing of ourselves through words and deeds. Judaism's vision is of a society of selves made more whole. Our vision is to be a blessing. In my almost 18 years as a rabbi, I see people moved and motivated by this vision every single day. As well, I see people inspired by the vibrant Jewish path that leads to our vision's fulfillment. Every single baby naming and bris, every passing of the Torah from generation to generation when a child becomes bar or bat mitzvah, every love that is celebrated under the chuppah, I see it in the aha moments of learning amongst children and adults. I hear it in the songs and the spirit of Shabbat. I see it in the smiles of our children as we introduce to them their stories, their poetry, and their music. I see it in the faces of those who are ill when they receive outreach from their community, a meal, a visit, a handmade blanket. I feel it in the hug of those who have lost a loved one and who have found in the Jewish tradition, their Jewish tradition, and in her communities a source of comfort and strength. I see it in the bright smile of those who return from visiting Israel, discovering in this ancient but modern place a home that they never knew existed. I see it in our children, younger and older, when they embrace the temple as their second home, a safe place to explore and question and grow, and yes, to just hang out. I see it in the satisfaction of those who give of themselves to better society because their values, values at the heart of Judaism, remind them that it is their responsibility to do just this. When it is that an overwhelming number of Jews in the Pew survey share that they are proud of being Jewish and feel a deep sense of belonging to Judaism, it is, I believe, because of all of these things that being Jewish represents. Many of the Jews in the pews that I meet speak much less of being religious and ritualistic, and much more of being spiritual. In this, I hear that while many people may either not believe in God or question what it is that they do believe, they do want for their lives to be counted and to be connected to something bigger than themselves. And Judaism offers a rich and a beautiful path to it. Many of the Jews that I meet speak less about wanting for their children, or themselves most certainly, to become readers by rote of Jewish texts. Rather, they want for their children to grow in resilience and in pride, to learn what is at the heart of being Jewish, and to create healthy friendships in a community that genuinely cares about them. I cannot begin to tell you how often it is that I find myself reintroducing Judaism and Jewish life to people who never knew that any of this was at the heart of being Jewish, part of Judaism's vision, part of our Jewish journey. For me, an essential takeaway from the most recent Pew survey is that we have much to do to bring our people into a deeper relationship with what it means to be Jewish. We must create congregations where people are more than welcomed, but where we are embraced. Our congregations should not be institutions, but rather communities, a holy partnership of individuals, couples, and families who choose to walk life's path together, sharing our stories and our hopes, our concerns, being inspired by our people's story and song, comforted by her traditions, inspired to action and enriched, perhaps even ennobled, by Judaism's wisdom. Our learning programs for our youngest children through high school and certainly beyond must be inspired, engaging, light-filled, and meaningful, helping our children to fall in love with being Jewish and instilling in them a curiosity and a closeness that as they get older, that will move them to become more spiritually mature, more giving, and more loving as adults. Our congregations should provide gateways into each other's lives and pathways that extend beyond our congregations to Israel, to Jewish overnight summer camp, to meditation retreats, to social justice conferences in Washington, D.C., or Tel Aviv, or London. Our congregations should be communities which partner with other faith communities locally and regionally, embracing common causes for justice. Our congregations must be communities of curiosity and inquiry, communities which are asking deep and meaningful questions and then responding to those questions and then asking some more. They should be places where everyone, whether they are Jewish or of a different faith or without a particular faith tradition, where everyone brings forward a voice essential to our shared conversation, one that has been going on for over 3,000 years. Our congregations must be communities that inspire us to become the blessing that we are called upon to be. I have a tremendous faith in the richness, depth, and joy of Judaism and of Jewish life. And I continue to have tremendous faith in the Jewish people, whether they are JBRs, Jews by religion, or JNRs, Jews of no religion, or somewhere in between. I have faith that as long as we do our job, keeping the eternal light vibrant and warm, inviting people to come, I have faith that increasingly our people will discover their true home. Kenya Ratzon.
Thank you, gentlemen. What a powerful combination. Len talking about the head, Barry, the heart just comes out from you when you talk about the power, and then finally the hands really making it come alive here. Everything from hugs to meditation to retreats and, of course, Tikkun Olam. So now it is your chance to ask questions. One of the attributes of being Jewish, as I recall, is intellectual curiosity, right? And I think that's why so many folks came out tonight to learn and talk about the Pew study. So the way we're going to handle this is pretty straightforward. I think we're going to have microphones on either side of the room. So if you have a question, just raise your hand and one of our kind ushers will come over to you. And we'll start with this gentleman in the gray sweater. First hand up. And maybe you could just stand up and introduce yourself.
My name is Michael Bailey. I'm here from Temple Beth Shalom. I'd be interested in hearing what each of you think is the one most important action that you think our congregations should take in response to the findings of the study. You were to pick one.
I feel like I'm challenged now that I was talked about as a person who talked from the head. I'm not going to talk about the study because I'm not sure the study tells us what we should do. It describes who we are. We should learn from it. I've spent a lot of, a good part of the last dozen years studying two kinds of initiatives in the Jewish world. Summer camps, wrote a book with Amy Sales, How Goodly Are Thy Tents, and Taglit Birthright Israel. I wrote another book, 10 Days of Birthright Israel. with Barry Chazan. And what I've learned from the children, from the young adults, from the madrichim, the Mori Derek, the counselors, the camp directors, is that Judaism, I will say it simply, is a contact sport. That Judaism, to be Judaism, is a lived experience. And it is an integration of the head, the heart, and the body. I call it the Kishkes, kinesthetics, and cortex principles. And that I think synagogues, the lesson that they need to draw is that they need to be living communities. And they need to be communities. And the ritual, which is the context, and the ritual, by the way, which is the barrier for many, and has to be overcome by the connection and by the sense of community. And I will say that does come from this study, because every single, or nearly every single person comes back to, in their responses on the survey, seeing themselves as part of a people, part of a tradition. It's not necessarily how you do that tradition, it's feeling that you are part of the group.
So I'll give you the broad one answer, and then I'll break it down, you know, just a little bit. I mean, you know, I know failing synagogues, and I know terrific synagogues. And there's one huge difference. Somebody in a successful synagogue remembers what the mission of a synagogue is. The mission of a synagogue is the intellectual, moral, ethical transformation of every young family that walks through those doors. That we want to have an impact on those people. And will wake up every morning, like I do, saying, how have I failed the Jewish people? How can I help the Jewish people? And it doesn't lead to a lot of sleep, but it's every rabbi I know is working super hard, and all the members of the board are working super hard, and they are, but you gotta remember what you're in business for. You know, we are, as I said before, we are dealing with populations that are the result of 100 years of raging assimilation. And nothing wrong with it. I mean, my grandfather, you know, felt like being a good American was the most important thing he could do. He didn't think he was abandoning Judaism. It's just, hey, he was coming from Kiev and pogroms. This country was the best place in the world. He didn't want anything. I mean, he didn't think we were gonna disappear. It wouldn't have crossed his mind that would be possible. But it's a powerful assimilatory civilization, and to fight it means to be continually trying to, not to do away with, God forbid, not being fully part of America, but on the other hand, to keep reminding people there's something beautiful here, something amazing here. So, you know, I think that when a new congregant comes into the synagogue, you ought to sit down, every one of them, and say the following simple words. If you think you can drop your kid off here once a week and expect that this thing is gonna work, you're just wrong. That's not gonna happen. This is gonna take absolute effort on your part. So, you know, do me a favor. We have an excellent Hebrew school. We're putting a lot of effort into it, and so are you, but, you know, guess what? Go take a look at the Rashi school, you know, or Solomon Schechter, or some other, you know, take a look at a day school, because it's pretty hard to teach a 3,500-year-old civilization. You wouldn't send your kid to a half a day a week secular school and expect the kid to come out an educated part of Western civilization and culture. So take a look at that. And if you're not gonna do that, take a careful look at intensive Jewish summer camp. It works gigantically well. Just take a look at it. You know, you won't send your kid to Camp Wachahoochee this summer, you know? In other words, it's a challenging conversation. It's not a simple conversation. And there's other things. And by the way, having a couple of Jewish books in your house and actually knowing something about it yourself, so when your kid comes home and says, Hebrew school doesn't interest me, you could say, you know, guess what? There's a lot of interesting stuff there. Look at our bookshelf. It's filled with Jewish books. I took May, I took some Jewish education. I took an adult bar mitzvah. There's something there. I'm telling you, there's something there. It's transformational. So all of the, you know, it's a simple
conversation. It's an admission of our limitation and the fact that we need other. By the way, in the reform, every one of those things is part of the movement. They're not somewhere out there. You have your camps. You have your Israel travel. You have your adult educational stuff, and we'll help you with all that stuff. But that conversation is about knowing what your job is with that young family. You can't let them leave 6 years later spiritually unscathed. You just can't do it. So that's my suggestion.
First of all, I want to thank the questioner. Michael Bailet is the current president of Temple Beth Shalom. So I'm mindful of my answer, although we talk about these kinds of things all the time at Panera on during our weekly meetings. At the risk of being overly simplistic, but it's our house, so I can do that. I think that if we can do one thing, and one thing can lead to several other things, I think you have to care. I think that when somebody comes into encounter with our community, that we care. Tell me your story. Tell me about you. Tell me about your family. What do you dream about? I want to share with you what this community is about. And we'd love for us to share a relationship with each other. And we'd like to grow together. And along the way, we're going to sing, and we're going to dance. We're going to find inspiration. We're going to hug and hold each other when it's really hard. And we're going to lift and elevate each other when it's a time of joy. And you're going to find, I hope, that as we grow in our relationship with you, and as you grow in relationship with each other, because this isn't a relationship with one, this is a relationship amongst, that this relationship will be counted amongst some of the most important in your life. The most important relationships in our lives change us. We are better because of them. If you are blessed to be in a long-term relationship with someone that you love, you are different today than you were the very first day that you met them. You're deeper. You're more thoughtful. You are touched by the love that you share. That is a covenant that links the two of you. When you come into covenant and into relationship with your circle of family and friends here in the Temple community, we want you to be changed too. We want you to grow. We want you to be more thoughtful. We want you to be more compassionate. We care about you. We care about your kids. We care about your grandkids. All of a sudden, the voices of Rashi and Rambam and Maimonides, the opportunity to step onto an airplane together and experience Israel, the opportunity to come and let me step into a conversation about God and to pray, all of a sudden the gateways are open because we care, and we really do. If we could do one thing as a congregational community, it's to deepen our pathways to sharing how much we really do care.
Great.
My name is Gerard Badler. I'm a member of Shir Hadash, the Reconstructionist shul. By the way, we're one of those groups that generally is kind of not all that certain about the God thing either. I read most of the 200 odd pages of the report, and it takes a bit of time, but I would recommend it to everyone here. It's worth reading. But as I concluded reading the report, I kind of scratched my head, and I sort of wondered, what exactly is the problem that is in search of a solution here? If you say that the goal of Judaism is to maintain itself, well, then the report does a pretty good job of suggesting there's a problem, because it clearly makes the point that those Jews who are unaffiliated with the religion tend to care less about other Jews, tend to care less about Israel, than Jews who feel more attached to Judaism. But if you say the primary goal of Judaism is to create a population of individuals who are morally upright, who are involved in social action, that sort of thing, which apparently most of the respondents felt were the essential for Judaism, then it's not clear that there's a problem. There may be, but the report didn't make that point statistically. It didn't look at whether the unaffiliated Jews were any different in terms of their moral uprightness or their level of social action than the Jews who did feel highly affiliated with Judaism, religion or not. So I don't know that it's going to be terribly easy to get people involved in trying to come up with a solution to the problem if it's not clear that there really is a problem. Maybe these young intermarried Jews are just as good people as people who are not, who are affiliated with the religion. And so, you know, why are we so concerned? Are we simply concerned about maintaining the tradition come what may, or are we concerned about raising morally upright people?
Very thoughtful question, thank you. So perhaps we'll have one or two of you respond just so we have time to get to a lot of questions. Who wants to tackle defining the problem?
Do you know what it means, what that means statistically?
I just want you to go ahead.
Nonsense. you know, in my experience, being Jewish, what is most important is being a good person and caring about the world. That's just a default answer. Doesn't mean a whole lot. It doesn't mean a whole lot about what they are or what they're going to be. And it doesn't say much about what the future really is going to be. I belong to a generation, all of whom thought, all of whom 100% of everybody I ever talked to, when they were actually capable of talking, you know, were deeply engaged in social justice. I grew up in the 60s. You know, half of them are, first place, you can't predict anything about the future anyway, because half of them who wouldn't have walked into a synagogue in their lives are synagogue members, and some of them are presidents of synagogues. God help them. And they changed radically. And I do not, see, as I said before, I think this social justice thing, if you think that we can be exactly the same as everyone else, totally part of American society, and end up at the end of the day any different than American society? What do you think, I mean, is this thing that we all say we care about social justice, you think it's like we're genetically superior? You think that's what it is? Or do you think it has something to do with the stories that we tell generation after generation after generation? Those stories are gone, in my view. Our connection to social justice could easily be gone as well. How will we be different than anybody else? So teaching what Judaism is all about has to do with a whole range of things that holds us together, but it also certainly has to do with social justice. It has to do with culture. But the other part of it is I'm not just interested, in fact, I'm not interested at all in how many Jews there are going to be in 100 years. I care about being, I feel bad if most of the children being born today are denied the opportunity to gain the joy and meaning and caring and purpose that comes out of being, out of knowing something about what it means to be Jewish. I mean, it isn't about, there is no problem about the numbers. I mean, like I said, if in 100 years everybody stands up and goes, I actually believe in a better world and I love the one quarter of me that's Jewish. But what is that? I mean, what is that? What have we given up if that's what we say? What if in 100 years, do you think that in 100 years America would believe in democracy if nobody remembered the story of Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or the American Revolution or any of the things that represent the culture of democracy in America? What would we be? We'd be nothing. We would have forgotten everything. And a culture of amnesia that remembers nothing will lose the essence of what you think is the most beautiful about Judaism because it'll all be gone.
Okay. So, just real quickly, for those who aren't on Barry's list, he did a beautiful drash for Thanksgiving and wrote about the links between the story of the pilgrims and their motivation for coming here. They thought the New World was the promised land. They were escaping the king, the pharaoh. And they even brought Rashi and Maimonides along with them. And they came to establish a new kind of society based religiously, based on promoting social equality and justice. And my own take, and this goes beyond the data from the Pew study, is that over the last several decades, as we have become increasingly wealthy as a country, as a society, and individualism has run rampant, that religion is one of the antidotes. Religion is the thing that keeps reminding us that we weren't put here simply to have larger cars and houses and bank accounts and make more money. And I think the concern is that were we to lose our religious foundation, that within a generation or two, and this is the fundamental concern about the data, that if we lose having a Jewish connection with one another, we lose the concern that is and the foundation for caring about other people. And I will tell you, again, from my study, my studies of young people, one of the things that I encounter with young adults today, with college students and post-college students, is that they are hungry for actual social interaction. They spend so much time connected to their iPads, iPhones, etc., in virtual contact with other people, that the experience, for example, of being on Taglit, of being on a bus with 40 actual people for 10 whole days is and becomes a life-changing experience. And I think that's what our religious communities do, and that's why there is concern about the findings to the extent that they suggest that Judaism and the culture that has existed for $3,500. Sigmund Freud is alive and well. Is not going to be sustained.
It's interesting, weaving together your two ideas. The number one practice that was most prevalent amongst all Jews is the Passover Seder,
right,
which is our story, has huge, you know, social action implications, and of course you do it with other people. I mean, there's talk of doing them virtually, but by and large people still get together. There's a question here in the front row, and then we'll take you afterwards.
I don't know whether the Pew report had anything to say.
Give them the mic so people can hear you. Yeah, Jason, would you hand the mic? Yep. Please.
I don't know whether the Pew report wrote anything about politics.
Yes.
Well, nobody's mentioned it here, so I wasn't educated on it. But it's interesting to me how the Jews have been consistently voting between 60% and 80% for the last many, many, many years, more liberal than they haven't. Basically, it's been democratic. and that's been consistent, just as we have Jews in this survey shows that the people who identify in some way or another with Judaism has grown. And yet, man, some gentleman in the middle
Barry.
Doesn't, Barry, I guess it was, wants to eliminate social justice from what we teach our kids in the doing. Well, then I misunderstood it. I don't remember my son, he's now an adult, coming home from Hebrew school and ever talking about social justice or anything having to do other than with religious aspects of kosher and et cetera, et cetera. But I think it is extremely important that the culture continue and the education having to do with charity and doing that to others, et cetera, is extremely important, and putting that with Judaism and not having one and or the other.
Yeah, the answer is, no, I didn't say that. The opposite.
Then I apologize.
The opposite. It's very right.
Okay, why don't we do this? There's a lot of hands in the air.
Take a couple.
So we might take a couple questions at once and then weave them together. So we'll start with you, Jason, and then we'll go over to...
Yeah, in reference to birthright, you mentioned 250,000 ounces have been sent over there. And I'm just curious, and from a tracking basis, Len, and you guys do a lot of research, and Barry, when do you think we'll see the results of what's happening? Because they definitely have changed the landscape of what's happening.
Calculate results. Do you want to ask your question? We'll do a couple.
Sure. A few months ago, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary spoke at Temple Emanuel, and he made the statement that he thought synagogues had to change from just being religious organizations or places to community centers, but not community centers like the JCC. So I would like to know your reaction to that idea, and how do you think that can happen?
Great, and this is the third question right here, and then we'll tie them together.
Yes, I'm Ron Levy. One thing that the Pew study did treat, and other surveys of the Jewish population have dealt with, is intermarriage. And we have skirted that topic this evening to a great extent. Now, I don't know if the topic is a glass that is half full or half empty. So it's a two-part question that I have. What are the data on intermarriage in terms of, is it increasing, and are the non-Jewish spouse converting, and are the children being brought up as Jews in a family, an intermarried family? And the second one is, what is the community, and the whether it be the federations or the temples, what are they doing about intermarriage? And what should they be doing that isn't being done?
Okay, so maybe Barry, you'll handle Tagliat. Len, do you want to talk a little bit about intermarriage and synagogues as community centers?
Okay, so the three questions were
Tagliat. There's so much passion
The three questions were Tagliat and
the importance of Tagliat. The important intermarriage, how do we think about it, and synagogues as community centers?
So, you know, on the intermarriage question, it's sort of like, again, it gets back to the last thing I said when I was talking. It really depends on what we do with it. I mean, it's not going away. It is there, and it is growing. But it really is related to everything else that we were talking about. You know, if our synagogues aren't filled with energy and beauty and vitality, they won't attract the interfaith families. And if they're not welcoming and caring, they won't attract interfaith families to become part of our community. In my experience, interfaith families, like all Jewish families, have similar dynamics. A synagogue that's not good for its own members, that doesn't fill them with joy and passion and caring and all the rest of those things, and justice, if they don't, then neither the in-married families nor the interfaith families. One of the most important things that we do, we put a lot of resource into outreach interfaith families, but we put 10 times as much resource into making our institutions strong and beautiful, filling them with meaning and learning and everything else. If you do both of those things, then we'll do much better with in-married families and much better with interfaith families, but otherwise we're going to have, you know, we're going to have problems on every level. It's, again, it's what we want to be, not what we are, that really counts. And Tagliat is very much part of this. I mean, I didn't talk about Tagliat because people tell me that I only talk about Tagliat, so I'm trying to restrain myself here. But he'll tell you what the numbers are. But the numbers are amazing. Amazing. I mean, cutting the intermarriage rate in half, gigantic increases in support of Israel, all kinds of good things, except the one thing that at least the data a few years ago said was that kids who go on birthright don't necessarily get involved in the Jewish community. In fact, they don't, compared to the ones who don't go. And the reason for that is most people, most communities are doing nothing. No follow-up. Here we have, all my life, I've dreamed about an immersive experience for every American Jew. We knew that that would transform the future. In studies that were done in 1970, 1972, and 1975, we knew that what we had to do, we just never did it. All of a sudden, we have, this year, 35,000. Maybe there are, depending on how you count the data, 70,000 Jews born every year in the United States, 80,000, 90,000. But 35,000 a year going to Israel, on top of the 10,000 who go anyway, and you know what a trip to, why do you think Federation sent people to Israel? it blows their mind. They come back, they give us their house. I mean, all we're asking of the young people who go are their souls. I mean, it's take my soul. I need my money for my life. Anyway, so it's an amazing thing. We got to do something with it. If all it does is, what it does beautifully is create a much greater sense of peoplehood and love of the Jewish people in Israel. That's great, but if it's not followed up with something that enables them to see the richness of Judaism, and that's what we're committed to doing. We're committed to bringing every kid who comes back and engaging them in some serious way in Jewish life.
So I can't resist saying a few more things about Tagli. I'll do it real quickly. The data are that in the short term, it changes their lives, and they come back connected to Israel. One of the most incredible developments over the last decade is the growth of Israel studies on campuses. I think many people think of campuses as hotbeds of anti-Israel sentiment. In fact, there are now more than 1,000 courses about Israel taught at virtually every university across the country. And what we've been doing is following in particular people over the long term. Now, one of the problems with young people is that, and it's actually an effect of birth rate, Taglit, is that they're not marrying. At least they're not marrying at the rates at which we expected them to. We thought that half of them would be married by age 30. It's now more like age 32. But those who are married, the in-marriage rate, as Barry said, is 50% greater for participants on birth rate than similar other people. And what it is really a proxy for is engagement with the Jewish community. Because virtually all of their children, I mean all of their children, are being raised as Jews. And even the youngest children have naming ceremonies and Brit Milah, etc. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary finding. And the biggest impact is on the children of intermarried parents who have a very low rate of marrying Jews and creating Jewish households, and their rate increases over 100%, more than doubles. It's really quite extraordinary. In terms of intermarriage more generally, the study found basically a leveling off of the rate of intermarriage. But really, and the reason that Taglit hasn't yet had an effect on the rate of intermarriage is because they're marrying so late. In about 5 years, you're going to see a dramatic change. It'll be a drop in the intermarriage rate. But the arithmetic of intermarriage is such that it only takes one Jew in an intermarriage to produce a family. It takes two Jews, kind of inefficient in an intermarriage. And what the study found is that the rest of the country is actually catching up to Boston with the vast majority of children of intermarried parents who consider themselves to be Jewish, or at least one parent considers himself to be Jewish, raising Jewish children. That's one of the things contributing to the population increase. In fact, intermarriage is responsible for a good bit of the population increase. We thought, in 1964, Look magazine thought, Alan Dershowitz, in his book, The Vanishing American Jew, thought that intermarriage was the end of the road, that these folks would not continue to identify as Jews. Surprise, they want to be part of Jewish communities. And I'll just say, the Reform congregation, the Reform, of those people who identify as Reform Jews, 50% are in intermarried families. 50%. Now, one way to think about that, and I'm going to be the positive spinner here, is wow, isn't that beautiful? Isn't it beautiful that the Jewish community and the Reform Jewish community has been able to engage and welcome and make a part of the community all of these folks who in an earlier era would have been lost to Judaism? You're going to hear a lot of people who say it and spin it just the opposite. I don't think that's the right way. And in fact, to continue with my sports metaphor earlier, the ball is in our court to make Jewish life for these families, like all families, as meaningful as possible.
Right. And I would only add on to what Len just articulately shared, is that while it is that statistically speaking, one-third, a little over one-third, happens to be involved in congregational life as a photograph of this moment in time, it's important to note that the vast majority of Jews, regardless of whether you are Jewish by religion or not by religion, the vast majority of Jews spend significant years as members of congregations. The question were turned around and said, how many of you have for a period of 5 to 10 years been a member of your congregation? Even if you yourself are not a member of a congregation now, you would see the number shoot way up to, and we can go to what that's specific, which means that congregations, as speaking as a congregational rabbi, congregations have extraordinary punim to punim opportunity with our people. Extraordinary punim opportunity for our people, which means understanding that the families that come through our doors are not statistics, they're people. And when we engage and encounter them as people and we take them along, we have the opportunity to transform lives and inspire them to transform other people's lives and to make the difference that we want that difference in the world to be made. So I would also spin the statistic in a very positive way, is that we have amazing, amazing people in our communities. And the more that we engage them, the more that we share with them, the more that we learn from them, the deeper our community is going to become. And by definition, when it gets deeper and more real and more authentic and has much greater integrity, the broader it's going to come, because people are smart. And they want to be a part of something that brings substance and meaning in a world that is oftentimes chaotic, difficult, and confusing.
Thank you. So,
may I ask a question since I'm carrying a microphone?
Of course.
My thing. Did you mean just the Reform movement, the three of you gentlemen talking tonight? Where is the Orthodox? What are the figures on the Orthodox? What are the figures on the Conservative? You talk about Reform. I didn't hear anything unless I lost it, because they may have a different meaning. They may have a different direction.
Len, do you want to do a quick? Just make it quick, because we're
going to... I forget the exact statistic. I forget the exact statistic, but one of the things that happens is that people move from the other movements into the Reform movement, and one of the reasons they move is because they're intermarried. I forget what it is, but it's a snapshot. Any figure I would give you is a snapshot of something that is changing, and is changing rapidly because of the profile of when intermarriage became more normative.
Well, the study says that the Orthodox are growing at a pretty good rate. And especially among children, very significantly growing because of higher birth rates. But I think, you know, the lesson of all this is that we need everyone to have a healthy community. We need the Orthodox with what they bring to the table. We need the Reform because of what they bring to the table. You know, we had our Maya instructors. Some of you took Maya. You know, something like a third of the Maya instructors were from the Orthodox community, very open, very engaged. We need everybody's wisdom and passion, each in their own way, the openness of the Reform movement and the caring of the Reform movement. And there are great strengths that are still hidden in the Conservative movement, but you can see them in the truly great Conservative synagogues, what they can mean to the community. And the Orthodox community has stores of wisdom and intelligence that properly applied can be a blessing for everybody. Any one of us, any movement, any one of us can either be a blessing for the Jewish future or something not so good. It's all up to us.
So I promised a 9 o'clock end time, and that's why God, if there is a God, created Kiddush, so that we can continue the conversation. over that. So I want to again thank Len and Barry and Rabbi Jack for what is really a night of both insight and inspiration. And before we break, I'd love to invite up Rabbi Todd Markey to conclude with a blessing for all of us.
When the Pew study was first released and I heard and read so many of the initial commentaries, my assumption was that Pew was an acronym for pessimism emerges widely. But in fact, I would invite each of us, and just as our panelists have so graciously tonight, invited each of us to define for ourselves what it is that Pew stands for as we define what we and our communities stand for. May we nurture P, purposeful lives committed to our ethics and repairing what is broken in our world. May we, E, engage one another in relationships of depth and of meaning. And finally, may the W, wisdom of 3,500 years of our tradition inspire us to realize a 21st century destiny grounded in our rich past and dedicated to a truly radiant future. Amen.
Amen. Amen. That was interesting. Hey, you should take as a compliment that called you had.
Jay, thank you. Thank you for being here. Pleasure. Thank you. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. It was a really great night.
I've heard about you, but I haven't met you.